welcome to The Law Report. Damien Carrick here. Last week, lawyers representing residents of the Queensland town of Oakey announced that they will press ahead with a class action against the Department of Defence. About 450 residents want compensation for dwindling property prices due to contaminated groundwater emanating from a nearby defence base. Now, these days we don't give class actions a second thought, but they haven't always been around. In fact, this month marks the 25th anniversary of the commencement of class actions here in Australia. So how well does the scheme work? That depends on who you talk to. Belinda Thompson is partner with Allens, a leading top-end-of-town law firm, which acts for many large corporations. Andrew Watson is the national head of class actions with law firm Maurice Blackburn, who are the biggest plaintiff law firm operating in the class action space. As you'd expect, the pair have very different views.
A class action is really just a mechanism by which you aggregate a whole number of claims that arise from the same, similar or related circumstances, and one representative takes on those claims on behalf of everybody who's been affected.
And how well do you think this system works?
Well, I think you've got to judge a class action regime on three criteria: access to justice, increased efficiency in adjudication, and whether or not you've added to the realm of private enforcement. And I think on each of those three criteria, our system's worked well.
Belinda Thompson, what's your view?
I agree that those are the three objectives for which the class action regime was introduced, but 25 years ago, the legal landscape has moved dramatically. And I think one of the features that we're now seeing is a huge amount of entrepreneurialism between plaintiff law firms and litigation funders. And I do think there's a real question as to whether, in fact, access to justice is almost becoming a byproduct of our class action system, with lawyers and litigation funders actually taking a huge cut of the pie.
Okay, that's what we're going to unpack in this conversation. Andrew Watson, is there one case that you say speaks to how well the system operates?
Well, there's not one case. You know, our recent cash converters case, which was a case for some of the most disadvantaged consumers in society who were affected by payday lending, is a great example of how the case works. Another case we did for nursing home residents who'd been severely abused was a fantastic case. I'm still incredibly proud of the work we did on the bushfires cases, both of which achieved enormous record settlements, $500 and then $300 million.
We'll come back to that one a little bit later. Belinda Thompson, are there any cases that speak to you as demonstrating that maybe this regime doesn't work as well as it might?
Yes, look, and I think there are examples where you can't say class action doesn't always work, but there are examples where I think it does call into question the scrutiny that should be given to class actions and whether they always achieve necessarily their objectives. We've got extreme examples like some of the Mark Elliott type shareholder class actions that have been stopped in the courts because of abuse of process.
Who's he?
Mark Elliott's a former corporate law partner who's taken it upon himself to really start up his own legal practice and also associated litigation funding entities, which started up a proliferation of shareholder class actions. And the way he did it was to buy a small parcel of shares in a number of different companies and then, some would say, opportunistically start up a class action if there was, for instance, a profit downgrade disclosure or the like.
And I think in a number of cases where he's been involved with, the courts have actually thrown out those cases and described them as abuse of process. Is that a correct description?
Yeah, indeed. Cases like Treasury Wines and Leighton's and the like, the courts have held, and the recent Meyer case, the courts have said this is an abuse of process because the predominant purpose is nothing to do with access to justice and ventilating legal claims. It's all about generating income either by way of legal fees or litigation funding proceeds for Mr. Elliott and his associates.
So you're also raising there, Belinda Thompson, this idea of shareholder class actions. And Andrew, I want to maybe speak to you about people when they think about class actions, they think about product liability cases, disasters, but there has in recent times been a big growth of shareholder class actions, and I guess that's a way where shareholders, they're normally actions against the company themselves for alleged inadequacies in continuous disclosure practices. And there are also a lot of financial services claims where investors rely on what they say was some sort of misleading and deceptive conduct when they made that investment. People like Belinda Thompson, and we'll come to her in a moment, would say that that's not really what class actions were designed to do. What would be your view?
Well, I think that's wrong both as a matter of history and as a matter of the fundamental sort of philosophy that underpins class actions. But first, I mean, let's be clear. There's been a significant growth in shareholder class actions over the course of the last 10 years, but that came off a very low base. Up until 2003, there was basically one. The most recent data that Professor Morabito from Monash University has suggests that shareholder class actions are sort of around about the 15% mark of all class actions, and then separately investor class actions around about the same, slightly more. But there have always been those investor class actions. There's actually been not very much growth in recent years in that investor class action space. There has been growth in shareholder class actions, but as I say, from a very low base. In the second reading speech, when the class actions regime was introduced, the minister actually said that one of the circumstances which would be open to be used for class actions under the proposed new regime would be shareholders getting together to enforce their rights. And indeed, that's what's happened.
I imagine plaintiff lawyers often think of it in terms of a market mechanism for transparency and governance alongside the sort of other forms of regulation through ASIC and ACCC.
Well, it's not just plaintiff lawyers who describe it in that way. ASIC, on a couple of occasions now, has recognised that class actions play a private enforcement role in relation to transparency in the market. And that role is a complementary role to the public role that ASIC and others play.
Clearly, ASIC and the regulators do recognise the private enforcement role of class actions. And indeed, you know, where there is an appropriate basis to look at a claim, you can't say that that's always not appropriate. But some of our research indicates that, in fact, the figures are higher than the figures that Andrew's quoted. So we did research over a number of class action filings between 2005 and June 2016. Over the last 18-month period of that research, 28% of class actions were in the financial services sector, 30% of class actions were in the shareholder claim sector. And I think the other thing to remember is these are often the very big class actions. They put a big burden on the courts. They put a large burden on corporates in terms as the defence. I guess one other thing I'd just say is that it's not a question always of a particular type of class action, but also whether the class action's appropriate in the circumstances. And one of the other things our research identified was a number of new entrants into this market, the new kids on the block, who perhaps are seeing, if you're cynical, the dollars out of the class actions. And so law firms who otherwise don't have the experience in the class action system, starting up, we would say, on a perhaps more speculative basis, class actions that perhaps someone like Maurice Blackburn might not be looking at.
So even though you might be on opposite sides of the fence, you're actually saying that you don't mind dealing with people like Maurice Blackburn who kind of know what they're doing, generally speaking. But there are plenty of law firms which are kind of entering the space and perhaps don't quite know what they're doing.
Well, I think there is a question as to whether sometimes some of the class actions are more speculative than others, particularly when you see, you know, a profit downgrade in the press and suddenly class actions announced the next day. That in and of itself causes a lot of expense, time and money being expended by variety of people, including the corporates.
Playing devil's advocate, you know, look, we have this system, and if people think they have a strong case, then bring it on.
Indeed, and I'm not denying that people have the right to ventilate their case in the court, and there's, you know, real need for access to justice. But the way our courts have approached our class actions regime is that it's a relatively low threshold to get these cases up, and it can take a lot of time and expense both from the court system, the defendants, and, to be honest, the plaintiff lawyers incurring legal fees before even you can actually have the thing scrutinised properly.
Okay, well, let's talk about the economics and the funding models. Belinda, you talked before about litigation funders. members. Now, traditionally in Australia, you know, you either have group members themselves funding a court action or you have lawyers acting on a no-win, no-fee basis. But in recent years, we've seen the emergence of litigation funders who are essentially investors, right?
Yes, essentially they're a third-party litigation funder who says, we're prepared to cover the legal costs of the case while it runs, and in return for that, if you get a win in a judgment or you settle a proceeding, we'll take usually a pretty large percentage of the amount of money.
In Australia, we don't have contingency fees like in the States where you can lawyers can say, we're going to take a certain percentage of the court ruling, damages ruling. Belinda, what's your view of these litigation funders?
Again, I don't think you can make a huge generalisation about all of them. There's some litigation funders who are there, they're well entrenched, they're sophisticated, they're commercial, they understand the risks, they'll make decisions based on those risks and all the circumstances. But again, we're seeing an attraction of a lot of new players coming in, and it's an almost totally unregulated market. It is something that, you know, we personally think should be subject to further regulation.
Before I go to Andrew, these people are hard-nosed business people. They wouldn't put their money if they didn't think there was going to be a return.
Well, they might not put their money where they don't think there's going to be a return, but there's an element of being prepared to gamble on a number of different cases to get that return. And I think there's a question also as to whether or not there's an appropriate safeguard for the different parties as to the involvement of those funders and the ability, for instance, to get your costs against offshore funders. Now, the courts are trying to grapple with those sorts of issues, but in terms of, for instance, capital adequacy requirements and the like, it's a very unregulated market. There's some very upstanding, you know, long-term funders who themselves have put that sort of regulation there, but there's a lot of new players on the block.
Andrew Watson, if I can come to you, what's your view of litigation funders and some of the criticisms put forward by Belinda Thompson?
Broadly speaking, I think the opening up of the litigation funding market has improved access to justice for a number of players in potential litigation, and that's because the representative plaintiff, even if they can get a lawyer to wear the costs, it has to take on the burden of any potential adverse costs order should the case lose.
And that's the way it works in Australia.
That's the way it works. But of course, in a class action, that might mean that you may have suffered several thousand dollars worth of loss, but be required to take on the obligation of a cost order should the litigation go badly that's in the millions of dollars. That's not a sensible or rational equation for most people. And so litigation funding creates a circumstance where the litigation funder takes on that burden. I wouldn't agree that it's as unregulated a market as Belinda says. There are general consumer regulations and there's some limited financial services regulation, but I think the courts in particular have taken a very active role so that it's not uncommon now to see litigation funders who are based overseas to be ordered to put up security for costs in the order of $6 million or so. I've personally seen figures of that kind on at least three or four occasions.
Are they skewing the market and in doing so distorting the kind of public policy rationale for class actions?
Well, generally speaking, it is still the case that in most actions, even with the payment of the lawyer and the payment of a funder, the bulk of the money is going to the class. There have been some instances where that's not been the case, and those instances on some occasions I think have been rightly criticised. But one answer to this is one that you adverted to, which is that we have been saying for several years now, if you want a marketplace where there's real competition, let lawyers charge a contingency fee, and that will actually drive down the costs for consumers.
Would the big end of town like to see contingency fees in Australia?
Contingency fees are always contentious. You know, we have moved a long way away from the traditional position where you couldn't get some sort of share of profits because we've got the third parties doing it now. But the High Court approved third party funding because it said, well, at least you've got the lawyer there as an independent party. So that is a real question about how you have contingency fees but keep that independence and don't create conflicts.
Andrew, coming back to you. So generally speaking, Maurice Blackburn don't use litigation funders or do
no,
they do
we,
in some,
we,
time, some
we,
occasions?
Do use them on a number of occasions and usually in cases that probably have a more commercial aspect. And then when we're acting in cases which might be regarded as more directly for the public good, we tend then not to involve a funder and we do those on a no-win, no-fee basis.
You mentioned the Victorian bushfires case a little while ago. That was Black Saturday class action settlement for $494 million, I think, after about a 16-month trial. Now, there was such criticism of Maurice Blackburn from some quarters, some of the claimants saying that the fees you charged were too high, and I think there were something like $35 million and then something like another $24 million for external costs like barristers and experts. And it took a long time to distribute, and I think some of the distribution still hasn't happened. What do you say to that idea that in class actions, sometimes the plaintiff lawyers take too much?
Well, let me just talk about the bushfires matters first. The costs in that case were enormous. It ran for the best part of 6 years. As you say, there was a 16-month trial, and throughout that time, we were on risk for the entirety of our fees and for all but a very small portion of the disbursements. The fees that we were awarded after the court had considered two independent reports from different cost assessors who'd both said that we would actually have been entitled to much, much more. So in one case, $69.5 million, and in another case, $77 million. So we actually took a cut in our professional fees. We didn't ask any of the barristers or others to take a cut in their fees. Overall, even though it was a very large sum of money, it was in total 12% of the damages award in that case. And in Murrindindi, I think the Murrindindi bushfire, it was 6%. You'd go a long way before you found any other form of litigation of that scale and magnitude where the costs were, as a percentage, as low as those two percentages. It's the most complex thing I think we've ever done. It involved assessing 2,200 or 2,300 personal injury cases and around about 13,000 individual property cases. Each involved an individual assessment. It took us longer than we'd anticipated, but with luck, it's going to be concluded in the next couple of weeks, and that will have taken a shade over 2 years, which I don't think is unreasonable in the circumstances.
Now, acknowledging, Belinda, you act for the big end of town as opposed to the little guys. I mean, what's your response to what Andrew's saying?
Well, look, I can't comment on the specifics. I do think the bushfires tragedy is, and the litigation is the type of thing probably the class actions are there and designed for. And a litigation funder would take a much larger cut of the legal costs. The question of how the funds are then distributed, which has perhaps been more controversial, has been subject to the court supervision. And I guess to a degree you need to accede to that. But I do think the question of how you deal with all those individual issues and don't end up with just a further mass of work and fees is something that we do need to continue to monitor.
Mm-hmm. I should acknowledge that we've got two perspectives here talking about class actions. There may well be a lot of other people with different perspectives who we can't include in this conversation, but I should acknowledge that. And an opportunity to take a free kick, and you didn't do it, Belinda. That's very interesting. You're listening to The Law Report on radio or via podcast. The podcast is available from the RN website and also from iTunes. We're talking on the 25th anniversary of the commencement of class actions in Australia. I'm speaking with Andrew Watson from Maurice Blackburn and also Belinda Thompson from Allens Lawyers. Now, another contentious issue around class actions is finality. Belinda Thompson, in November last year, there was a decision, I think, in the High Court in the case of Timbercorp Finance. Why is that case, from your perspective, problematic?
In Timbercorp, the High Court was asked to consider whether individuals who'd been group members in a prior class action could raise further claims that were not raised in the class action to try and invalidate their loan agreements that they'd used to finance their investment in Timbercorp. One of the objectives, of course, of class actions is finality, along with access to justice, because that's one of the things that achieves efficiency. And the court said, when they looked at the Timbercorp class action and the issues that were raised, they said, well, these are particular issues here. The lead plaintiff ran those issues on behalf of the group members. But even though that failed after a long trial, lots of costs, the group members could then go on and agitate further individual claims. Really, calling into question the extent to which finality will always be achieved in a class action. So now we've got the Victorian Supreme Court dealing with a plethora of individual claims after they've already dealt with a class action.
Andrew Watson, that would appear to suggest that the class actions aren't kind of the efficient one-stop shop for dealing with these sorts of cases. What's your view?
It was a pretty unique set of fact circumstances. It was essentially brought in effect as a defensive proceeding to try and stop the enforcement of certain loan agreements.
Against the investors
against
in the Timber Corp
investors.
Finance schemes.
Yes. And so to that extent, it's a relatively unusual set of circumstances. I also don't think we should get too excited about the prospect of this kind of problem, to the extent it's a problem, breaking out all over the place. Because, I mean, we've run a jurisdiction for 25 years and this is more or less the first time it's happened in this way. I think we've got to understand that there will always be limits to the extent to which you can say a class action will provide finality. For example, under the regime, people have a right to opt out. And so you can't forever guarantee that everything is going to be resolved in one action. So,
as a matter of practice, though, if people know that the class action is on foot, they don't tend to opt out, do they? They tend to want to piggyback onto the class action which has already started.
Overwhelmingly, they do. But some people do exercise their opt-out rights, somewhat rarely, but in some instances, they bring their own separate proceedings. I don't think it's a mark of the failure of the system. I think it's a recognition by the High Court that you're constantly in those proceedings striking a balance between that which is common and which you can determine on a common basis and that which is genuinely individual. And getting that balance right can be tricky, but I think to date we've generally done pretty well at it.
Now, Andrew, you mentioned the opt-out model. In terms of a conversation about finality of the class, I understand that in a recent case, I think it was the Orco case, I'm not sure if it was your firm, but the plaintiff's firm in that case wanted to get access to the share register because they sort of said, look, we want to contact everybody who might be a possible member of the class so we can say to them, these are your rights. As a matter of principle, do you want to have access to share registers?
Well, yes, and it was our firm. The Orco case was a shareholder case about, again, a failure to disclose. We alleged their accounts were wrong and that they'd failed to disclose a particular feature of their loan facility, which ultimately drove them broke. What we've traditionally done, and the regime clearly works on the basis that you don't have to give actual notice to everyone. So what we've traditionally done is we've done advertising in newspapers and sometimes we've put things on websites and so on. But in the Orco case, we were able to gain access in a practical way to the register. We had to actually get the company to consent to its use. And what that did in that case was demonstrated that the use of the register actually enormously increased participation. And so from the perspective of the access to justice point, it just seemed that that was a really practical way in which you could improve the participation of shareholders in a case. Now, it won't work outside the shareholder sphere, obviously, but it was a really obvious and practical way in which in the shareholder sphere you could improve access to justice.
Belinda Thompson, what is your view of the idea of opening up share registers to plaintiff lawyers?
I struggle to see the need to open up the share registers because, as Andrew's indicated, historically, and the system was designed to provide for the ability to people get general notice of class actions, the ability to themselves communicate if they wanted to participate in a class action without the positive contact being required. It's an intrusive element, and I think we should be slow about sharing personal information of people if they don't want it.
Yes. You're tapping on their door.
They're tapping on the doors, and I guess there's a real question. Are you asking them to participate in the class action in the sense of participation in a damages claim, or are you tapping on their door to see if they want to sign up to a funding agreement?
It's a difficult philosophical question because people do have rights, and a lawyer saying you have rights and you have options here, shouldn't they be told of that?
Well, yes, but it's a question of degree, I think, as to what point are you saying well, you can publicise the class action. People read the newspapers, people see the press, they can be informed of these things in many ways. But do you provide their personal and private information to plaintiff lawyers they otherwise have no contact with for the purpose of them being proactively contacted? And many people wouldn't want that to happen.
I don't know. I mean, if you're told that you have been wronged and here's an opportunity to rectify that, I don't know if too many people would be too upset about that, would they?
No, but they have the right to participate without having knocked on the door if it's an opt-out system. It's just a question, I guess, whether they need to sign up to a litigation funder, which is where we've ended up to with many of these cases, with requiring them to actually opt in, which is one of the developments that the funding market has created.
And do you find that plaintiff lawyers are asking for access to those share registers increasingly?
They'd like as much information as they can about the potential class and the size of the class. It all goes to the value of the claim.
On some levels, wouldn't providing that information actually help in that regard, because you can more accurately and perhaps quickly define who is and who isn't in a class?
Yes, and indeed there are processes that, for instance, in the lead up to a mediation, often you will provide for a registration process so that you can actually understand the scope of the class and the scope of the claim to mediate the claim. But that's been usually done by the system of advertising, newspapers and the like. Doesn't always necessitate the personalised contact that might be the case with a share registry.
Look, we could talk for hours, but we have a limited amount of time. Finally, Andrew, 25 years on, are there anything you'd like to see change with class actions?
Oh, there's lots probably, but fundamentally, of course, I've indicated I think our system's working well. But there are substantive law changes that could I think would be important, like improving the capacity to deal with the overseas cartels, like improved protection for whistleblowers. And then there are procedural things, some of which are already being trialled. I think the federal court's idea of having case management judges has worked really well. I would like to see depositions tried as a way of getting to the heart of matters quicker. I'm more generally up for anything that can be used to increase the likelihood of settlement, so that I think there's a real case for the court at the outset setting up a separate kind of mediation stream for these cases, so that you've got your judge who's managing the case, but you've separately got a mediation stream.
Belinda Thompson, 25 years on, what would you like to see?
I think it's a good opportunity to look at how our system's operating and whether the pendulum has been swinging appropriately in terms of access to justice, efficiency and the growing commercialisation of the class action market. So things I'd like to see, for instance, are a careful regulation of the litigation funding market. And I also think it would be useful if there was an opportunity for some greater scrutiny of the cases up front, to actually look at how's this case being structured? Who's the representative plaintiff? Is this the best vehicle to articulate the claims? Is this the best way for group members' interests to be pursued? And is it not exposing corporate defendants to what may be relatively speculative claims, so that those things can be nipped in the bud earlier rather than later and avoid all the angst that they cause?
Belinda Thompson from Allens Lawyers and Andrew Watson, National Head of Class Actions with Maurice Blackburn, thank you both so much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to technical producer this week, Kieran Ruffles. Now, if you access the Law Report as a podcast via iTunes, please do rate and review the program. It helps other listeners like you find programs like us. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.